One of the things that is a learning from AI is enthusiasm for learning completely supersedes existing knowledge, right?
Let's go to the Gen Z question and debate. It's always that the young lead this, but how much Gen Z is driving usage of AI is just crazy. And I know
Staggering.
you see it at home with your kids. I see it at home with my kids. They are truly AI native. They
Yeah.
don't know the search world. They don't know the their journey starts with AI
Yeah.
for everything.
The concept of trying to ensure that while they love their job and are doing what they like, they also want to make sure that that is not the only thing that is dictating how their time is being spent. And experiencing everything that is there at offer for them is a priority. And I wish I had been like that.
Hi everyone, very excited about this podcast. My guest today is Rahul Chaari, co-founder and CTO of PhonePe. 700 million users, 1.5 trillion in USD in TPV. Honestly, it's not a company that needs an introduction. All of us use it every single day. Profitable, heading towards IPO. But for me, Rahul Chaari, and he's Chaari for most of us, is a friend and advisor. He's probably the most thoughtful CTO in our ecosystem, and I call him the top five CTOs in India, or technical thinkers in India, and someone I lean on for advice whenever there is this big tectonic shift in technology. And it's not just me, it's regulators, it's people in the ecosystem. Everyone will go to ask Chaari for advice, and he's always very generous both with his time and advice. And so thank you for that. He's also someone who supports a wildlife nonprofit together, and he missed the last trip into the jungle to see the gorillas. His wife didn't, so you still owe us
100%.
that trip. So excited about this.
Thank you so much for
And
having me, Vikram.
thank you for being generous with this India AI Edge report. I know your time is at a premium, but I know you really dived into this. So that's the context of this conversation. So we'll talk a little bit about AI, what you're doing with it. We'll talk a little bit about and rehash this dinner conversation that we had about Gen Zs. So stay tuned for that. But let's start with how you embrace this shift with AI and what resonated for you. I know we have had this 2x2, which you said, hey, this actually looks like our journey of going from tinkerers to democratizing AI through the organization and then becoming transformers. So just talk a little bit about your journey, and maybe we'll put up your quote for our viewers as you talk through it.
Sure. No, I think for us, it was fairly organic. Frankly, I also went through the grind of, is this real? Is this hype? How much do you lean in? At the point that you do lean in, how do you lean in? Do you get significantly more focused on outcomes? Or do you actually go the route of trying to actually experiment more? Luckily for us, we've always had this gene of trying out stuff, being more experimentative, always been very input-oriented before trying to actually over-index on outcomes. And that's nothing to do with AI. That's just how we operate as a company and specifically as a technology team. So specifically with AI, we had this track for the last 4+ years, which was a small team that started organically in a federated manner through the company called DevEx, which is basically developer experience, right? The focus being on improving developer experience and thereby leading to a happier developer community within PhonePe and therefore higher productivity, right? So the DevEx team has been focusing on various initiatives. Our documentation, our discovery of our existing features. We are an extremely large code base. The CI/CD pipeline, how to improve it, how to actually make build times faster. Bunch of these, right? All the problems that are horizontal in a large developer community within the company, That was the focus of this team. It was a federated team.
Can I ask when this started and what is the core ethos of it? Because I find it very interesting that you started something which was sort of more inward looking and said developer happiness is important as to drive for the company.
Yeah, I think it comes through again from surveys that we do about how engineers are feeling within the company, right? In terms of the tools that they have at their disposal, in terms of their ability to actually take code live, frustrations around our stage environment, which is a classic problem in most companies, frustrations about the QA cycle in the entire development process, frustrations around build times being very large as the code base becomes huge, frustrations around the merge request being very slow. So all of this keeps bubbling up, right?
Yeah.
These are conversations. They start as cooler conversations. They become louder. Then through the tech all hands, they come as feedback. So there was a realization that these are horizontal problems irrespective of which team an engineer belongs to, and it needs to be addressed. So then we started this model of, okay, what are the solutions? Then folks do have solutions that they want to try out. That becomes the federated model, where engineers from different teams raise their hands to say that let's fix this. From that, we built a core team called the DevX team. Then we started actually formalizing a charter for the DevX team, brought more people together dedicated on that problem statement. Now, when we decided that, look, let's lean in on AI. This isn't just hype. There is reality. We leaned on the same team to try and start doing experiments.
So was it existing engineers who were, you know, tinkering with AI, or was it sort of a new team, very young folks tinkering? How did that happen?
No, existing engineers tinkering with AI, nothing to do with levels, nothing to do with whether they are freshers who have joined the company or architects within the company. I think one of the things that is a learning from AI is enthusiasm for learning completely supersedes existing knowledge, right? So same federated model where there was interest to try out AI capabilities, bring them together. One thing that we did, I think, is a very, very important thing is we decided never to actually fall for the trap of trying to get output oriented very fast. In fact, we actually set expectation. Even when the noise became extremely large about what are we doing with AI, where's the AI leverage? I actually set expectations with the board saying that this year, and this was about 2 years back, is going to be all about experimentation and input orientation of trying to actually build the scaffolding, enable the teams, see what the results are before committing to any output metric being higher productivity, faster deployments, or any of those. So we spent a year, and I think that worked out really, really well. So this team then started tinkering, as you would call it, in terms of what are the different tools that can be used, which are the our existing IDE, are there good plugins to make it the harness to actually leverage the coding models themselves?
Yeah.
Do we have to build or buy for different parts of the SDLC? Mapping the SDLC itself into various parts and looking at solutions in isolation. Documentation, right? Auto-generation of documentation from code and making them highly searchable with an LLM layer for query on top of it was taken up by just as one part of the problem statement and enabling just that piece. Right. So we broke the SDLC also into different parts, started looking at building tooling, buying tooling, experimenting with it, then standardizing it for the organization and saying that now let's roll it out before we actually anchored on the output metric.
So clearly started with a lot of engineers going at it with, you know, engineers with high learnability going at it. When did it go from there to other parts of the org to it becoming more, you know, you started seeing a lot more ideas come from other parts of the org? So then it becoming truly strategic, top-down, saying, hey, we are going to invest in a AI front-end, which is where you ended up.
So it was with engineering for the longest period of time. A lot of the workflows, right, once we had actually solved for the infrastructure layer, whether it's a LLM gateway that we have so that we can actually route it to an on-prem model or to a hyperscaler model, whether it is to actually have vector data stores for storing model meta. Once we had all of that, we started building and simplifying workflows for engineering itself. And that kind of evolved into being a little bit of a marketplace of agents, which we call as Agent Hub today. Once we got to that stage, we started seeing a lot of pending automation of ops workflows within teams.
So you said marketplace of agents, agent hub.
Yeah.
When did that happen? Was it because people were just shipping agents and other people wanted to use those agents and then you had to put this marketplace together?
It was basically saying that, look, every team now is got into the application layer or the harness layer, the orchestrator layer, where you can now take advantage of probabilistic models and their output and feed them into a workflow. Let's take entire KYC workflow.
Yeah.
And to be able to say that, how do we actually leverage some of these models in the KYC workflow more effectively, right? Into even code review flows, right? How do you actually create a simplified code review flow that has a AI agent in the loop and brings a engineer or human in the loop only after the initial results are summarized? Debugging, all of these. When we realized that now there are multiple data sources and there are teams that are individually building flows and orchestrated models on top of these, we decided to bring them all together, build knowledge bases, build an auth layer on top of that, create layers that allow us to integrate any MCP, internal or external, seamlessly. So when we realized that now there's a fragmentation of these flows, we said, let's platformize it, which is a standard thing that we do, whether it's AI or not. When we look at any sort of data flows within the company that are getting replicated across various teams, we actually standardize it and bring it on a common platform. That's exactly what we did with Agent Hub. When Agent Hub became real for the technology side, the automatic extension was pending automation of ops workflows in every team, which I believe that as a company, we've done a much better job of automating through and through. But we also still have a huge backlog because prioritization typically goes towards immediate business asks, consumer features, merchant features, etc. So the natural extension was, why don't we actually automate some of the ops workflow? And from there, realize that now it can become a mandate and then become something that we say that all functions, corporate functions, business functions, start leveraging this with support from the core team, which have now graduated from being tinkerers to transformers and enablers for the company. We then made this into the core AI team, everything from approvals for new tools with a policy that actually makes sure from a data privacy perspective, data retention, access, there's a approval framework, as well as a clear model of, okay, if this is a new tool, let's do 3 months of experimentation. Because there's, in this fast evolving world, every day, there's something new that is coming out that is challenging what you're already using.
Yeah.
But trying to actually bring in everything is both a time sink and a cost sink. So this team also owns the final decision on trials. We don't want to stop trials.
Yeah.
But we now have a clear model of what's the outcome of those trials. And then there's going to be a call of whether we move forward or we're going to stick to what we already have. So I think that was the journey of this federated set of engineers tinkering with technology that we thought is going to be transformative but weren't sure, then coming together as a team, trying to anchor different parts of the SDLC into a more formalized manner using AI, from there building out marketplaces for our tech workflows, and then graduating to saying that let's take this for the entire company.
As always, it's just such an incredibly thoughtful rollout, and now I can actually understand the quote that I read somewhere, which is, you said, don't rush into AI, make sort of rebuild the foundations first so that you
I
can.
I got quite a bit of flack for that.
Like,
too cautious an approach. I've been called out as saying, as being somebody who is always too cautious, not looking at AI as the disruptor, positive disruptor that it is.
Yes.
But I strongly believe that engineering scaffolding. So I think taking an engineering first mindset to AI is very important, because you can create outcomes really, really fast. Taking those outcomes
live at scale.
So
for a non-engineer, explain that. When you say engineering first mindset, you're essentially saying durability matters. I guess overall quality and longevity and durability
100%.
Matters more so than anything else. And of course, I know you love elegance of design as well. So what is that engineering mindset?
So the engineering mindset is to say that creating functionality that works really, really fast doesn't mean that that piece of code is production ready. Now, if you are a single user app that you're distributing this to friends, creating whatever functionality you have is directly production ready.
Yes.
if you are a enterprise solution where you have a small number of clients and you are more bespoke about what you do, you can actually move faster trying to say that I'm anyway bespoke. So I'm building this out per client, and therefore that's my business model. If you're somebody like us with 700 million plus registered users operating at a population level scale, you have to look at multiple aspects of it. Ultimately, there's a data access layer that has to have performance, reliability, and security at the core of it. You have to actually be sure that these models running at the scale that we are doing in real time across the data stores don't bring down any of the data stores. At the same time, the latencies are acceptable, and therefore there's a rollout process that...
So what did you have to change? And I know both of us are friends with Rohit of Axel Data.
Yeah.
And he was telling me that what I asked him this question on why is AI failing at production scale.
Yeah.
And he said, now it seems like the teams are ready, the tech models are ready,
yeah,
but the data stack is not ready and you need to do retooling of that.
Yeah.
Did you have to go through that journey?
To some extent, yes. Like I mentioned, we had to actually first build out at the core what we have as our LLM gateway. You want to be able to always have the capability that you're not bound into any one single frontier model, purely either from a cost perspective or the ability to keep experimenting with newer ones. To actually have something like that.
And so every time those models change, are you sort of tweaking what that model stack is?
We don't tweak the model stack at all. What we tweak is the underlying model that we are plugging into and the percentage of traffic that is going there. But applications can be completely agnostic of it because they go through an LLM gateway and they are agnostic of which model we are hitting. That allows teams, whether it's the data engineering team, the data sciences team, or any engineering team that is owning this, to keep experimenting, right? To be able to actually ensure that access and an ETL pipeline that transforms from being a batch process to almost being real time, which is what Rohit might be referring to, becomes extremely important.
Yeah.
We've always had a separation in the company.
ETL about is extract, transform, and load.
So typically you have large data warehouses which work on an ETL pipeline that is designed for offline analytics much more. To actually try and take as much of that into online processing is something that becomes extremely important.
Yeah.
Trying to just fit in what you have as batch processing systems into real-time models is a big failure. So some of these is the scaffolding that you have to take care of. And therefore, an engineering-first mindset at scale before you actually rush with taking AI live is the topic of discussion that you're referring to.
For users, I think what might be most relatable is the AI search that you launched along with Microsoft. So just talk a little bit about what were the choices, and then, you know, today it seems like there are other chatbot type platforms which might be faster, but you have gone for more reliability again.
Yeah, so when we launched our AI search, we had two parts to it. One is what we call as universal search, and universal search, which was already existing within the app, transforming that into being supporting NLP, natural language processing, that you can actually convert any speech to text in any language, understand the semantics of it, the context of it, and give the right results. That was one aspect of it. And that runs on Azure OpenAI models on the cloud. Then there was the transaction insights, which is basically to be able to actually ensure that you're having a conversation with your transaction history, to be able to ask any question. What are my month-over-month spends? Is it trending lower or higher? During IPL, am I ordering more food? Is my spend on Amazon too high? Any of these questions, right? To be able to actually support that, which is a very domain-specific model. We chose that as the use case where we could go hybrid and start working on an on-device model.
Yeah.
And that's what we've done with Foundry, Microsoft Foundry.
So this thing about this on-device model and making sure that you're using the edge is a big choice, right?
Yeah.
And there's some overall conversation that that's where India should go, because then you can use the edge compute, and that using that edge compute might be the secret sauce to getting AI inferencing at population scale.
100%.
Was that a thought? And
so the thought was to solve for three things. One, ensure that you don't have a significant amount of dependency on high compute on the server side, becoming one choice whenever you're taking any new consumer feature live. Two, cost, keeping the cost low. Three, and the most important thing is that if you're building inferencing models that are very use case specific, you don't necessarily need to actually leverage large foundational models at all. There is no use of that, right? Mm. You don't need a 32 billion, 64 billion model, etc., for many of the use cases that we are trying to take to the consumer. And I think India should think like that.
But it sounds like you're taking very intuitive calls because you're building for 700 million people.
Yeah, and the last one is privacy. I think the conversation around privacy has just started in India. DPDP is going to go, the rules are going to go live next year. I think people are getting more conscious about their data and how the data is being used. If we are actually going to have to leverage the data the maximum for consumer goodness, at the same time adhere to a very high level of privacy, I think having edge models that don't farm the data and are using all the data that's available on the device, if you're able to gain the trust and actually roll this tech out at scale, you're going to actually be able to deliver significant value to the consumer.
Yeah. I love this conversation, and there's this question that we're grappling with, which is how do you get AI inferencing to work at population scale? And you've taken some choices, right? Which is to say edge is an important choice. Not using too much network because of the way our data networks are, that's an important choice.
Yeah.
For it to work on top of DPDP is a big important choice. For it not to use foundational models because you're doing use case specific
you don't
inferencing.
Need to use.
All of this essentially is almost like a tailor-made architecture for India versus I wouldn't see any of these choices in global apps.
I think in a lot of global apps, it's taken for granted from both cost because there's so much capital and also from the overall infrastructure that is available and the amount of leverage some of the big tech companies have over the entire ecosystem. I think India needs to think differently. If you break up the AI world, so you one have infrastructure, which is basically all the semiconductors, the fab, and the hardware that is getting built out. Next is the frontier models, the foundational models, and that requires many, many years of research. I think we have taken good steps there, Sarvam being a great example. And finally, there is the applied AI economy.
Yeah.
I think India's role is going to be significantly on the applied AI economy. And in the applied AI economy, if we are to basically protect data and leverage it for India and build IP, I think going domain-specific models at low cost should be the approach.
I'm going to come back to this thread. Let's just round up. Actually, one thing I want to remark on is, you know, this conversation seems remarkably similar 10 years back to we used to say, what is the amount of memory this Android app is occupying on? And
what is the size of the download?
Is there going to be download fatigue? So that used to be the conversation because that's what it would take for Android app adoption. And it sounds like we're back to that same thing with AI. But it's actually interesting that with this technology also, that's what it will take. One thing before we go to this conversation around DPDP, DPI to the power AI, internally, have you guys built your own harness? As we have tried to go from our journey of tinkerers to transformers, we realized that unless we have our own harness, which is actually doing memory management, micro context management for some of the skills and agents that we are running, it doesn't run the way we want to. And we don't have the governance, compliance,
100%.
Security that we want to. And for you, that's a order of magnitude problem, which is much larger.
Yeah. So where we need to build and can build, we 100% build. Agent Hub is exactly that, right? Or everything that you spoke about, the entire harness or the orchestrator for building workflows, irrespective of the model that we're using. It could be models that we host on-prem on our hardware, open source models, where we run a lot of our batch processing for LLMs there. Or whether we are accessing Azure OpenAI. Agent Hub is our entire marketplace harness for creating workflows that have authorized access without folks having to actually create their auth keys on Cloud Console or anywhere else. They can create knowledge bases. Those knowledge bases have automatic access. They can actually choose from a marketplace of MCPs that we already have to be able to plug that into their workflows. So that's the harness that we have built. to solve for a bunch of things in terms of the ability to actually, for example, go deep into a link beyond the first page without being limited by the amount of memory, or to be able to actually scan all attachments in an email without being limited by a total 20 MB, 25 MB perusal of the documents. We've actually built that harness out because those were the limitations that we were seeing. In the development itself, we were anchoring on, for the development process itself, GitHub Copilot is our harness. So obviously, we don't invest much there. But in terms of trying to see whether we can build plugins that support or work with other companies that are building great plugins in terms of being able to inline within your IDE itself, detect dead code paths. Code Karma is a company that is doing really well, young company, bunch of folks, we work with them. So we look at, are there capabilities to add to the existing harness that we have in the development process? And obviously on the entire orchestrator layer, we built our own harness specifically for the reasons that you spoke about.
So let's go into this DPI to the power AI conversation. I remember maybe the first few times we ever met was when, you know, they were trying to figure out this UPI sandbox, and, you know, there were maybe 10 people in a room.
There was a hackathon also.
There was a hackathon. You and Sameer were still at Flipkart.
No, we had left Flipkart.
You had left Flipkart. And maybe just left.
Just left.
You were trying to figure out what you were going to do. You were very interested in this payments problem. I was one of the few VCs who was very interested in that problem. And those are the origin. And I don't think anyone will mind saying this, but other than the DPI team and the NPCI team, you're probably one of the biggest contributors to this entire DPI stack. So with that view, how do you think about DPI to the power AI? And at least the way I think about it is, this stack is tailor-made for AI to sit on top of it because you have this unique identifier, the data linked to that unique identifier, and a data consent layer. That means I should be able to build wonderfully personalized AI for every Indian. That seems like the promise.
Yeah.
Is that real?
I think it's 100% real. The promise is 100% real. I don't think it's just a vacant conversation, simply because of the fact that what DPI has done over the last 10 years is digitize data in such a way that it is AI ready, right? That's the way to actually look at it. Otherwise, all of this data would, one, not be digitized, which means effectively any sort of data, while AI is great at converting unstructured data into structured data, it ends up losing a significant amount of its coherence because of the fact that it ends up in a probabilistic way of actually transferring the data. We have actually crossed that, and there's nothing probabilistic about all the data that is available. This is exact raw data that is already digitized and is available in a machine consumable manner. So I think that makes the promise of using AI to accelerate the goodness that we can get from this is very, very real, right? And simply put, I think just the sheer fact that we have so many languages, and that is a barrier in terms of deeper financial services beyond just payments, and we're able to cross that barrier, or we should be able to cross that barrier fairly seamlessly by the combination of using AI capabilities and leveraging the data to be able to take that right products and map it to that person is a huge opportunity, right? So I genuinely believe it's a great opportunity. Where this will become real is going back to the conversation that I was having. Rather than try to actually force fit what we have today and say that let's just put a conversational chatbot on top of this data and let people figure out what they want, we'll have to start looking at very specific solutions. That's when I talk about domain-specific models, not just necessarily just the interface changing, but actually using those models to be able to actually personalize the products that are coming out of it. To be looking at whether it's in the insurance sector or in the lending sector, to go deeper into the, today we have very, very broad cohorts that we design products for, the manufacturers. I'd like to see the manufacturers use some of the data that is available through the DPI.
So what does that mean? You would say, now you need a product and maybe pick a use case like Threads. And say, maybe there's a product only for large bill invoices. Is that what you mean
exactly,
by sort of?
Exactly. And going down to taking every data factor that is available, geography, sector, person, history, and saying that can we accelerate creating products and approving products because of the fact that the ability to actually zero in on who this person is, what they need, and what can be delivered to them is highly, highly accurate, right? I think that's the journey that we have to take, whether it is on the loan side of it, the investment side of it, or the insurance side of it. I think the opportunity is to see what we've done today is because of inefficiencies or the inability to be able to actually farm this data at our population scale down to a person. We've tried to create fairly coarse granular products. To be able to say that, can we move away from that while also overcoming? So on one side, you will overcome the inefficiencies that exist because you're able to apply AI on top of the data.
Yeah.
The other side, can you actually start creating more personalized products? The marriage of those two is the opportunity.
I think it is a big mindset change to, I think Rajiv Ahuja called this going back to the bank branch of one. And truly say, because now we have actually created these bank branches for large cohorts.
Yeah.
Sort of work.
Yeah.
And that works in the app world.
Yeah.
But in the AI world, it is truly like that bank branch.
And it will require a mindset change across the board. It's not going to be like a few fintechs thinking like this will make it happen. So it's everybody from the policymakers, the regulators, the manufacturers, and the distributors have to all think like this.
For this to become real for the ecosystem, there's clearly a cost barrier. And we talked about some of the potential solutions to that cost barrier. What else are the friction points to make this work at population scale?
I think one is going to be, very frankly, deeper investment in actually creating more hardware and infrastructure that is accessible. I think the India AI mission is a good move in that direction. When I spoke about the three layers, I'm less worried about the foundational models and what is generally cited as a lack of intent slash capability research in the country to actually build those. I believe that we will actually do okay there. It's a matter of time.
And we'll do okay because of domain-specific real-world data tweaked.
Correct.
Yeah.
I think the part is around infrastructure, dependency on infrastructure, potentially the lack of manufacturing and capability to actually build large farms here. I think that one we'll have to overcome. We'll have to overcome by potentially thinking differently in terms of saying that can we actually build low-cost inferencing for these models? Can we build maybe application layer architectures that are different than how it's typically operated today? That's why I keep talking about understanding the hardware more. I do believe, while it's not my area of expertise, the teams have also discovered that if you actually go deeper into how the hardware is being leveraged versus just throw running models on existing hardware as is and farm the results, I think there's work that is needed there to actually figure out how you can actually reduce the cost of inferencing and building out these domain-specific models at lower cost from a hardware perspective. That, to me, is the biggest risk.
One of the things that's happening right now is a large set of investments are being made by the global model players, hyperscalers, all of them in India.
Yeah.
And the promise that India has is that, hey, we have this incredible data stack, so you can actually build very new, unique things on it. So how does India as a country and ecosystem play its cards such that, yes, you want this investment, but you don't want to become a data colony?
Yeah, it's one of the most discussed topics. Will India end up in this AI race as becoming just a data colony? I think at the cost of sounding like a broken record, if we do actually chase the opportunity on the becoming the applied AI economy, where we are solving the local problems without any sort of deterrence to be able to actually move forward there. For example, when we spoke about the availability of hardware, cost of hardware. As long as we are solving for the population, we are looking at models that are solving everything in AI-led agri, AI-led healthcare, AI-led finance, AI-led payments, and building custom solutions at the application level or the domain-specific models for India, And that means that there is that data that is enriching global players. But in that process, the capital that is coming in is ensuring that we are able to move ahead on this agenda without hardware or anything else on the infrastructure layer becoming a blocker. What is the problem? I think
I think that's
where my head is at, because I don't think we can play both sides and say that we want to actually leverage this and that's our opportunity. If we feel that we are behind in terms of creation of AI, but we are as operators, users, and application developers on AI, we still have the edge. We can't have it both ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so well said that we have to lean into AI. You can't wish it away.
Yeah,
it is incredibly powerful as a tool. We have the data stack. That seems like our right to play.
Yeah.
The question is, how do you convert it into a right to win it, or you know, a win for us, which is the promise is you can democratize intelligence and access using
AI.
Correct. So any investment where we are opening the data stack for global players needs to mean that they need to democratize access and intelligence for Indians.
100%.
That trade you can live with.
If that is, we are not delivering on that promise and then just giving data, that would be a travesty. But if the promise is being delivered and that data is enriching the global models ultimately, I think that's a cost, as long as the key areas of where data sovereignty is needing to be protected, things have to be localized, and that investment is coming in from a hardware, infrastructure, data center perspective, I think we should be okay.
Okay. Let's go to the Gen Z question and debate. So I'll put up the chart, and you know, one of the things that struck me from the OpenAI data was that it's always that the young lead this, but how much Gen Z is driving usage of AI is just crazy. And I know you see it at home with your kids. I see it at home with my kids. They are truly AI native. They don't know the search world. They don't know their journey starts with AI for everything. So how do you think about this overall Gen Z question on both recruiting them, managing them, giving them advice on their early careers?
Look, I think you're right. I think at some points it's very difficult to actually see how they look at their careers. The concept of trying to ensure that while they love their job and are doing what they like, they also want to make sure that that is not the only thing that is dictating how their time is being spent. And experiencing everything that is there at offer for them is a priority. And I wish I had been like that over the last many years versus build up this entire list of everything that I want to be doing when I'm post 50. So I do have respect for that. I think the one that specifically, I think coming to the AI part of it, and I think when we're talking about kids also, it's the same thing for the new engineers or the workforce that is coming into the industry. Using what is at your disposal to get things done as fast as possible versus using what is at your disposal to get things done in the best possible manner, I think the tendency is to lean on the former than the latter, right? Like with our kids, if there is an assignment that they need to actually submit versus actually giving the laziest prompt to get an output and submitting that versus thinking how much more deeply they can actually think of the assignment, and in the same time that they would have delivered a 7 on 10 report, can they do a 9 on 10 report because of this and go through that? There, what is happening is they are improving and they are learning. Similarly, I think if you take on the workforce, I think the problem is that with AI assist, say in the engineering part of it.
So engineering, I think across functions, I worry that a lot of the early apprenticeship and early journeys that you and I went through were doing a lot of the grunt work.
Yeah.
Then taking it to managers, and then they making us redo that grunt work to go from 7 to 9.
Yeah.
And that taught us never to do that in that way again. And so always get to 9 on 10. and then over a period of time get patterns in our brain on sort of taste and judgment that helped are helping us make large choices today.
Yeah, yeah.
That journey, how does that happen for an early engineer, early cohort investor, is something I really struggle with, on what that learning journey is in their heads.
100%. And I think there are, I don't have a right solution. I do see that pattern wherein even whether it's code generation or output generation from anybody, using the tools without enough understanding of what that output is, there can be two outcomes. One is a continuous higher dependency on what you call as the workforce that has gone through the grunt as the checker for all the work that has happened and learning through that. Or they also looking at AI to actually replicate themselves so that they can actually be that checker. That could be one method to it. Or the hard way, where whether on the engineering front that results in one large outage where the learning is that, you know what, should have been on top of this well before and not having a view into how it's being done. We've seen some of those get reported in the media also from some of the large companies. I don't know where it's headed, but there is definitely a need to see how we can build some sort of scaffolding around this. I think there's also a responsibility on us when, as a ecosystem, we start measuring performance by things like the number of lines of code generated, number of tokens consumed per engineer. I think that's actually giving very wrong direction. I mean, the easiest thing is to do is to consume a lot of tokens, right? You could you could garbage in, garbage out with maximum amount of tokens means nothing. And I think trying to actually say what is the way you're going to be measuring folks and is that meaningful enough, and ensuring that that itself puts some sort of guardrails around the deeper understanding. For example, if for reviews on any large project, we are going to be looking at the quality of the technical specifications. When we in the early days, there used to be, when the waterfall model before agile development, there used to be a functional specification, then somebody reviewed your functional specification, gave you comments, then there was a design specification which has had the packet formats and everything else before you started coding.
Yeah.
Technically, you should have now the best functional and design spec, and engineering effort goes in there. And then you're able to actually use that to ultimately use the hardness and the coding models to generate the code. Looking at some of that and going back to the basics to say, are you building those skills and measuring performance by that might be a better approach. But frankly, I'm also learning.
I'm going to send my son to you. And he might listen to Chari Uncle because he's not listening to me. Because he's like, you don't need to do all of this. I'm just coding, Papa. And he's just going and writing. But because it is the power, that's the power that he has in yeah. hand. But right now, like you said, if he's right now shipping for a market of one, so it's fine.
He's sending an app to his friend and they're enjoying, hey, all power to him.
So let's do a sort of some crystal ball gazing on sort of like a victory parade for India on what has, if you just say that in 5-7 years, India as a country has been as relevant to this AI wave as it has been on previous waves on mobile and so on. And with that means that there's true India first innovation, like on the lines of a phone pay or UPI, something which is India magic that has gotten created, which then the world looks at and says, hey, you know what, this is how things should work at population scale and we can learn from it, which is what they've done on mobile and payments and so on.
Yeah.
For that to happen, right, what would be sort of one or two immediate big answers? And maybe you said cost and hardware, but and maybe that's what you measure in the next 12 to 24 months. But what does that roadmap to that victory parade look like?
I think the milestones really would be, is there a proliferation of sector-specific models and solutions that are coming about? Are there companies building on, whether it's on top of DPI or not, doesn't matter. Are there companies that are building sector-specific AI enablement infrastructure? Are we investing in those? I think would be the lead indicators. The outcome over the next 5 to 10 years is to actually take a measurable acceleration of each of these sectors, either from penetration or from a economy size perspective that can be attributed towards AI. I think that's the way to actually look at it.
And is there anything that we're doing right now which seems like a poor choice, which will really take us in the other direction and we will be the in the AI dark ages? What one choice would you really caution against?
I don't see anything that is necessarily a poor choice, right? I think right now the phase we are in is, I think the push towards AI being this next best thing after sliced bread is not a bad thing, which means that everybody is giving it significant amount of thought. A bunch of us are just going head in on it without thinking too much. Bunch of us are trying to think a little too much, and others are finding some middle ground. What it will mean is that you will see victories come out of this, which will anchor the right approaches, and from there, automatically, we'll all pick on those and then start building. So I think we are in that phase. We are in, at an Uber level, we are in the tinkerer phase. From these tinkerers, if 10% emerge as transformers and those become the template over the next 2 to 3 years, I think we are in the right direction.
Final thoughts for founders, builders, CTOs on top two learnings from your AI transformation journey?
I never like to give, giving a lot of advice on these never ages well. But I think...
Or maybe what would you have done differently in this journey?
A couple of things. I would have actually tried to go into a model where I am experimenting more at scale a little earlier and faster. I think we tend to be a little cautious in terms of experimenting. I think being much more about experimenting and not worrying too much from a what this means from a cost perspective or what does this mean from a distraction perspective, I think is important. At the same time, recognizing sooner and cutting some of those fast early and anchoring on the ones that are showing promise is the right approach. The thing that I think we got right was to actually have that input orientation first before going output oriented. I've seen a lot of folks fail on the output orientation where the promise of saying that, oh, I don't need a workforce, I can go down to a workforce that is half the size and take that as the forcing function to make things happen. Just one example, I don't think is the right approach to being input oriented and having a view that this is really working before actually leaning all in, I think is the one thing that I would actually tell folks.
As always, it's just such a wonderfully thoughtful conversation, and at least I can keep going on and on. But thank you for the time. I will remember many things from this podcast, but that initial thing about this engineer mindset, the promise of DPI to power AI, and what it takes from between to make it real, between the cost, between making choices which are very authentic and intuitive for India, and of course the domain specific models. I think they're just such like important nuggets for all builders out there. So I really thank you for that. When I think about this in the context of what we've put out, for us, the promise seems real. And it's fantastic to hear from you, who's so close to some of the users and the data, that you also feel the promise is real and it could go either way. And it does feel like we're at the tipping point. At least I am not of the view that we are behind, but we are at the tipping point that if we play our cards right, you can see a similar journey on the AI journey for India as we have seen in
100%.
Seen in previous technical
I fully agree. I think the choices we make from here, again, backed on the data that all the experiments are showing, will be key. But I feel that we are in the right direction. And thank you so much. Always a great conversation.
Thanks again.
You're watching Z47 Moments, the podcast by India's oldest venture capital firm, Z47. If you like this episode, consider hitting the subscribe button and the bell icon so you never miss an update from Z47 Moments.